Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Tom Mitchell, a global top-ranking scientist who is sharing his deep insights on machine learning, the brain, and policy. Tom, you have this amazing background. You've done an awful lot, so thank you for sharing your experiences with our audience.
It's great to be here.
Tom, you've got some amazing work that you're doing, and one of which is getting computers to learn to read the web. Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. So as you suggest, we have this research project going on, which is a project we call our Never-Ending Language Learner, or NEL for short. We call it NEL. And the goal here is to build a program that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and every day it has two things it has to do. One is to extract some more facts from the web by reading, facts like Obama is president or blue jeans are often worn with T-shirts. And then the second task it has to do each day is to learn to read better than it could the day before so that tomorrow it can collect some more facts more accurately. So we figure if the system could do each day both the reading task and the learning to read better task, then if we wait a few years, it could get to be pretty interesting. So we started this program running 24 hours a day in January 2010. So it's over 3 years old now. And the result so far is that it is indeed learning. It's a better reader today than it was last month, and it was better than it was the year before. And it now has a collection of 70 million beliefs, like the ones I mentioned, that it holds at different levels of confidence. And the ones where it's more confident in tend to be more correct, but there's still plenty of mistakes in there, too. But so that's basically what NEL is doing, and it's still running, and it's coming up on its fourth birthday. We have a birthday party every year. And I'm looking forward. We keep extending the algorithms that it's using, and so we're hoping that, you know, when it's maybe 10 years old and a teenager, it could get to be a pretty interesting program.
So from a pure belief in language kind of processing, would you say that it's better than a three-year-old?
You know, it's funny. It's much stupider than most three-year-olds in many ways because it doesn't really know anything that it can't get from text. On the other hand, it knows a lot of obscure facts that it's read on the web that I don't know. For example, it knows the names of thousands or tens of thousands of athletes and what sports they play. It knows the names of lots of cities and what airport is contained, you know, serves those cities and things like that. So it has, in a funny way, a much more complete factual set of knowledge than a normal three-year-old, but it's you know, it still doesn't have the kind of common sense that a three-year-old has.
And what's the underlying hardware platform for this NEL project?
The hardware is, let me tell a little bit more about the details of how NEL works. The hardware is a collection of about 100 computers that Garth Gibson, another faculty in our department here, runs as a research project, and he lets us use that collection to run NEL. On that collection of computers, we use Hadoop, which is open source software for distributing computing. But on that collection of computers, NEL has a collection of about between half a billion and a billion downloaded web pages, and it keeps adding to those. Google has allowed us permission to make 100,000 queries from NEL to their search engine each day. So NEL every day is collecting more web pages too. But maybe more interesting than the hardware is how the learning itself works. And I could take a minute to explain that. If you think about the problem of getting a computer to learn to read, one of the first questions you have to ask is, well, what kind of learning algorithm could you use there, and what kind of training would you have to provide? So, in fact, the way we've approached this NEL research project is to say NEL gets very little training. That is, it's primarily on its own looking at these hundreds of millions of web pages. So every when we started up now, we defined a collection of categories and relations we wanted it to read about. So, for example, we'd say, oh, we want you to read about people and about organizations and about furniture and about food and about emotions. And for each of those categories, we gave Nell a dozen examples. So if we said we're interested in furniture, we'd say examples are table, chair, etc. And then we also said, here are some relations. Not only read about these categories, but relations between the categories. So, for example, which person plays which sport? And we give a dozen examples of that. Alex Rodriguez plays baseball. So that's the training that we've provided now, is defining what's now about 1,000 categories and relations and giving a dozen labeled examples of each. Then based on that, what Nell has to do is teach itself how to learn, or teach itself how to read. And the way that it does that is roughly by looking for those dozen examples that we mentioned. So let's take an example. Suppose we say the category politician. And we say one of the examples is Obama. Then Nell might look for all of the mentions that it can find of the word Obama on the web, and it will take the words around that, like maybe it will find Obama was elected, for example. And it will take that as evidence. Every mention of Obama that it finds, it will take a look at the surrounding words and treat the fact that was elected occurred around Obama as some evidence that maybe was elected is a good phrase to look for if you're trying to find other politicians. And so it uses the seed training examples that we've given it to find the phrasings that occur around those seed examples. And then once it's found those, it uses those to search for more politicians. And so it might find, you know, Bloomberg was elected, and then have some probabilistic evidence that perhaps Bloomberg is also a politician. So it does this kind of iterative, starting with a small set of a dozen seed examples, and then find clues that surround those seed examples on hundreds of millions of web pages, and then use those clues or those patterns of text to look for even more examples of politicians. And once it decides, for example, that perhaps Bloomberg is also a politician, it will use those to then go look for even more surrounding phrases. So it's an iterative process, which takes now about a day, day and a half for each iteration. And it's up to about iteration number 800 now. And it's been growing rather substantially up to the 70 million beliefs that it has. But it also now has, you know, roughly a million of these phrases that it has learned on its own are indicators of different types of categories of items. And similarly, it learns about how to read relations. Like Bloomberg is mayor of New York. It learns to read in a similar way.
You know, it's interesting. It's going to be based on a sort of a statistical weighting of old information that's present on the web, but you're going to get disruptive new thinking that occurs, some emergent trends, and I guess it's going to have difficulty with that.
That's a good point. In fact, Nell does read new things as they come out, but it has currently a very poor understanding of time. So if you browse Nell's knowledge base, which, by the way, is on the web, if you search for it, you'll find it. And you can browse the knowledge base, and you'll notice that Nell does believe that Obama is president of the U.S. Nell also believes that Bush is president of the U.S., and Kennedy, and I think Jefferson. So it has found statements out there on the web that make it believe that this is the case, but it doesn't have the notion of it can't deal with the fact that they were all presidents at different times. So that's one of the, you had asked earlier about, you know, is it smarter than a three-year-old? This is one of the ways, temporal reasoning, in which it's much, much stupider than a typical three-year-old. And we're working on that, but we haven't solved it.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating work, this Nell project that you have in terms of computers learning to read the web. But I know you also have interest in the human brain. So how does the human brain represent word meanings?
So think about that. question for a minute. If I give you the word, let's say, mom, or the word computer, it's really the same brain, and the only difference is when I said mom, there was one pattern of neurons firing, and when I said computer, there was a different pattern of neurons firing in your brain. And we've become very interested in how the brain processes natural language. And for the past 12 years, with my colleague Marcel Just in our psychology department, we've been studying with brain imaging, with fMRI and MEG brain imaging, the patterns of neural activity that occur in people's brains when they read. So how would you study that? And we took a very much a machine learning approach to this problem. We put people in a scanner, say an fMRI scanner, and we show them simple single words initially, like table or hammer or house, and we would get a picture of the neural activity in their brain. It's a very complex pattern of neural activity. Hard to look at by hand, partly because it's a three-dimensional picture. Your brain is in three dimensions. But what we found was that we could train our computer program by giving it examples. Here's a brain image, and this person was thinking about hammer. Here's a brain image from the same person when they're thinking about house. Here's another brain image when, again, they were thinking about a hammer. And what we found was by training the program with that kind of data, we could then have the program successfully learn to classify new brain images that we gave it when somebody was thinking of the same word and have it tell us, well, for this new brain image, are they thinking about hammer or house? And so that's very valuable because it means that the program can discover for us the subtleties and the difference in the patterns of brain activity when you think about these different words. So once we realized we could do that, then it kind of opened the door to ask a lot of very interesting questions. For example, when you think about hammer, is it the same pattern of brain activity in my brain when I think about a hammer? Or do we encode, do our brains encode hammer in different ways in different people? And one way we could ask that is to turn it into the following machine learning question. If we train our classifier of brain images using data from your brain, can it then successfully decode the patterns of activity in my brain? And if the answer is yes, then that means, of course, that there's a very similar pattern of neural activity in our two brains. And the answer is absolutely yes. In fact, even though we've never scanned you, I'm sure that if we brought you here, put you in our scanner, and showed you the same words on which we've already trained our program for other people, that we could decode which of those words you're thinking about almost as accurately as for the people we trained on. So what that means in terms of human representation of word meanings is that even though we're all very different, we have remarkably similar neural encodings for these different concepts. And you might ask, well, why is that? Well, it turns out, if you look into the details, there's a very interesting hint of the answer, which is that, in fact, if I do give you the word hammer, I just did, in your brain, when I said that word, hammer, I'm quite sure that I generated neural activity in a part of your brain called the premotor cortex, which is part of the brain that's involved in hammering. If you actually use a hammer and move your hand in that way to do it, premotor cortex is involved in executing that action. And what we found in general is that for many words, like hammer, the parts of the brain that are used to represent the word meaning are very similar to the parts of the brain that are used to either for motor control with that item or sensory processes when you perceive the item. So if I give you a word like peach or apple, I just generated a part activity in part of your brain called gustatory cortex, which is associated with sense of taste. So anyway, these are some of the things that we learned now a couple years ago. If I could elaborate a little, I'll tell you that at some point then we started getting a collection of neural patterns, a little dictionary. We'd have, you know, in the dictionary, we'd have for each word, what's the pattern of neural activity that we observe when somebody reads that word. But If you think about what you would really like is an understanding of how word meanings are represented in the brain, what we had there was really just a list, you know, for hammer and for peach, we might have the patterns, but we didn't have a theory. We didn't have a predictive model that what you'd really like is, as an understanding, is some kind of theory where you could say for any word, you give it to the theory, and then the theory predicts for you what will be the neural activity for that word. And we've succeeded in developing not a perfect theory, but a pretty reputable one, in the form of a computer program that we trained. And this computer program, now you can give it any concrete noun, that is any noun that you can think of that describes a physical object, computer, table, chair, tree, snow, and it will predict. Even for words for which we haven't yet collected neural data, it will predict the neural activity for that word. And it's not perfect, but it's good enough that if you give it two words it has not yet seen the data for, let's say celery and airplane, and then you give it the two brain images that you actually collect for celery and airplane, and you ask it which one is which, then despite the fact that it has never been trained on either of those words, it's able now 85% of the time to tell you which of those two brain images goes with which of those two novel words. And the key to this, you think, well, how could you write a program that did that? The key is you need to have for the computer program a way to operationally represent the meaning of any word that it's given as input. And the key is we realized at some point we could use the same kind of data that Nell uses as the basis for representing word meanings. So just like Nell decodes politician by looking for the phrases around it, this program that predicts for a novel word what your neural representation will be, it uses corpus statistics as well, the statistics of what verbs occur around that noun if you look across hundreds of millions of web pages. So the way this program predicts for a new word like airplane, what the neural activity will be, is first it encodes or represents the word airplane in terms of how frequently airplane occurs with a lot of different verbs. And that profile of verb frequencies for airplane is the internal encoding of the approximate meaning of airplane that's then used as the basis for the machine learning program to predict the neural activity. So for me, the fun thing there is that it starts to tie together this research that we're doing on Nell of trying to understand how computers can learn to read, and it ties it together with the studies that we're doing of representations in the brain in terms of neural activity when people read. And that's very much a direction we're pushing on very hard now, is to put these two research projects even more closely together.
I guess long term there's some practical applications of this, but I guess the problem is that you're sort of averaging based on, you know, typical neural patterns and what happens in the brain. But, you know, if you have dysfunction like brain injury, then those neural patterns will get distributed. Have you done any work on that to see if it's still applicable to people who have head injuries and things like that? And I guess the idea also then, can you take this work and apply it to the animal world? For example, I know that certain kinds of birds, crows, for example, display some elements of intelligence, but their intelligence centers are not in the prefrontal cortex. They're in other areas of the brain, so it's almost like an alien brain. And I'm wondering if that work that you're doing now could be extrapolated to even different kinds of brain structures.
I think that's really a fascinating question. We haven't done that work, but I would love, for example, to put a dog or a monkey in a scanner and show them pictures of the same objects that we show words or pictures to people. By the way, if we show you a word or a picture, we get very similar patterns of neural activity. With the picture, we get more visualizable properties, like maybe we'll see a more detailed shape features. But if we show you a picture of a hammer or the word H-A-M-M-E-R, we get very similar patterns of neural activity. But I would love to put a dog, you know, or a monkey in a scanner and show them pictures of these items and just run the same analysis that we've run on people and see what the difference is in those patterns. Crows would be a little harder. I guess their brains are small, and so it's hard to scan them that way. But you also ask about longer-term applications. I guess I would say I do think that there are, in the end, if we can really get to an understanding of how the brain, let's say even just reads, then I think that will in the future provide a lot of opportunities for example, understanding dyslexia and different aphasias, different language disorders in a much more detailed and accurate way. I think for stroke recovery, people recovering from stroke who've had some kind of language deficit as a result of the stroke, the better that we can understand how the neural activity in the brain relates to the reading competence, then the better we'll be able to track and hopefully provide helpful therapies for stroke. We're not there yet, and I guess I would characterize the work we're doing as the underlying basic science that will hopefully provide the scaffolding for that.
Again, you know, really fascinating work, and there'll be sort of philosophical extensions to this work. I'm sort of reminded of this sort of phrase, cogito ergo sum, you know, I think, therefore I am, or maybe reverse, you know, I am because I think, or, you know, or you know, the work of Descartes, or even the soul, mind, body stuff, or Penrose. I mean, do you get into some of these philosophical discussions at all?
Well, I'm fascinated by these discussions. I'm frustrated by the fact that things like consciousness are not directly observable with the physical instruments that we have available. But I'll tell you, I read a paper that changed my thinking a little bit about this. I'll briefly describe it. This is some work by a researcher named Stan Dehaney in France, and he was interested in using brain imaging to study, let's just use the word awareness. And in particular, he did this. There's a well-known psychological phenomena that if I show you a picture, but I only show it to you for, let's say, half a second, well, that's long enough. You still are aware that you saw the picture. But if I show you the picture and I just flash it at you for 10 milliseconds, well, you're not even aware that I showed you the picture. So, you know, if you're looking at a computer screen and the screen suddenly for 10 milliseconds has a picture on it and then it goes away, you're not even aware that you saw that picture. Okay, so what Stan did was he got some people, and for each person, he measured how long would he have to show the picture so that 50% of the time they were aware they saw it, 50% they weren't. Okay, so it's on the order of 100 milliseconds or so. But if he shows it to you just for that long and he can measure it for each of us, then he can get to the point where you push the button to indicate you saw the picture half of the time, and half the time he actually showed it to you, but you weren't aware. Then he put people in the scanner and brain scanner and did this. And he measured what's the difference between the neural activity in the brain when you see the picture and you are not aware that you did versus you see the picture and you are aware that you did. And I thought, wow, this is a great experiment. And what he found was that there's a tremendous difference in the neural activity in the two cases. Very briefly, when you see the picture and you're not aware, there's activity in visual areas of the brain, but when you see the picture and you are aware, there's also an explosion of activity across the entire brain, across all of cortex, much of cortex. So there is a big difference. So that experiment I found, and still do find, fascinating in terms of maybe opening the door to looking at some of these questions that I always thought of as philosophical but not empirically measurable. And at least in the case of reported self-awareness or awareness of the external stimuli, Stan has shown us how to devise experiments that can distinguish those. So maybe there's a future of much more interesting line of work studying things like awareness and what are the neural mechanisms that underlie that.
So we've had a sort of an interesting discussion about your work in this area and some of the research that's going on. So I guess more generally then, where is cognitive neuroscience heading?
Well, I think it's a great time for cognitive neuroscience. I'll give you my personal opinion is this, that over the next 10 years, there's a big opportunity for research in cognitive neuroscience to merge with many aspects of research in artificial intelligence. And I guess you could take our own work that we were just discussing in computer understanding of natural language and studying how the human brain does natural language. The reason that I have these two research projects is I think they are two different ways of getting at the question, what is the mechanism that allows that form of intelligence, that allows language understanding to happen? And what I'm hoping for our own work there is that within 5 years, we will have not just a computer program where you can show it a single word and it will predict with some accuracy the neural activity when somebody thinks about that word, but instead we'll have a program that you can give it arbitrary text and it will read and understand that text. We can come back to what we mean by understanding. It will read and understand that text, and as a side effect, it will also predict the sequence of neural activity in the brain when a person reads the same text that it, the computer, just read and understood. So if you think about cognitive neuroscience in the future, you have to maybe start with the question, when we solve the problem of how the brain works, what will the answer even look like? Will it be an equation? Well, probably not. What will it be? My answer would be, it'll be a computer program that performs a very close approximation to the same function that the brain is, in this case, reading text. And as a side effect, the sequence of processing steps that the computer has to go through will mirror and predict the sequence of neural activity in the brain. So that's the kind of theory or model that I think makes sense as a kind of end goal for cognitive neuroscience. And in the, you know, this one case study of natural language processing, that's what we're trying to do. But I think, you know, if you're interested in studying computer vision or human vision, you can do the same thing. And in fact, Tommy Poggio at MIT is one of the people who has developed a program that analyzes photographs and, as a side effect, makes predictions of neural activity in human visual cortex if a person were to analyze the same photograph. We're doing that for text. John Anderson, here at Carnegie Mellon, a psychologist and cognitive scientist, has a program that can solve algebra problems like 3x plus 7 equals 10. And as a side effect of solving those problems, makes predictions of the neural activity in the brain when a person solves those problems. So I think the future for cognitive neuroscience in the coming decade is really more of that kind of work, where we don't just look at the neural data, but we simultaneously build computer programs that can do those same things that we're asking the brain to do. And then we look at the computer process itself, the sequence of processing steps that was required in order for the computer to solve the algebra problem or read the sentence or see the picture. And that sequence of processing steps becomes a model for what the brain is doing. So for me, that's the exciting opportunity for the coming decade.
You know, it's interesting. I guess we're going to have machines or robots that have the illusion of free will. And the issue is that when you have a robot with the illusion of free will or cognitive ability, then you're not going to get any controversy because you're just going to say it's an illusion. But at some point, you map that into the human brain, and then you can, you know, but the human brain or the human beings are loaded with a lot of controversy anytime you sort of get into this area of free will. And I guess eventually that illusion becomes indistinguishable from what we call free will in human beings, and then we'll say, you know, maybe they're the same. But anyways, I guess that's just a philosophical kind of question or comment.
Well, you know, on the issue of free will, which, again, this is one of those terms that maybe you can't measure, maybe there's no physical device for measuring free will. It's more of a philosophical concept that we talk about in many of the debates about free will that I read, I think are actually debates about how should we define this word. But putting that aside, let's take a concrete example. You've seen, I'm sure, a lot of recent work on self-driving vehicles. And sometimes I have to admit, when I come up to a traffic light, if it's yellow, I freely decide that I'm going to zoom through the traffic light before it turns red. And other times I freely decide I'm going to slow down and wait for it to turn red. So just think about self-driving cars and free will and making the decision to go through a yellow traffic light. And do we want to allow them to make that decision or not? And so forth, right? So if you think about how people program, actually they train, they use machine learning to train these self-driving vehicles, how they set that up. Basically, they set it up so that there are some built-in goals, for lack of a better word, let's call them goals, built-in goals for the program that are built in by the computer programmer. And for example, there's a goal to avoid steering commands that will result in sensing that you've bumped into the curb and so forth, right? And then the machine learning program, using the experience of the car, can train itself to minimize the number of curb bumps that actually happen. But similarly, we could say, you know, we want to minimize the number of red lights we go through. And if we do that, then the computer might learn that, well, if it's just turning from green to yellow, statistically speaking, if I go through this right now, it just turned from green to yellow, there's almost no probability that I'll end up going through it. It'll be red by the time I go through it. But if it turned from green to yellow some time ago, there's a high probability, so I won't do it. In that case, I would have to say the program had free will in deciding whether to go through the yellow light. On the other hand, if we didn't want to give that opportunity to the program, then the programmer themselves could have, instead of giving the command, don't go through red lights, could have given the command, train yourself to not go through yellow light. And so in a real way, it is up to the programmer to decide, at least in today's technology where we're using machine learning based on built-in goals that produce the training signals, it is up to the computer programmer to decide what those built-in training signals are going to be. And that's what defines the things that are going to be hard-coded in the program as goals and not subject to its own decision-making, as opposed to which things will be subject to its decision-making. So we could program the vehicle either way, to either allow it or not allow it to make the decision about whether to go through a yellow light.
You know, when will we understand the brain and what it does, you know, what does it mean to understand the brain?
You know, it's interesting to me when I started working in cognitive neuroscience about 12 years ago now, I spent a lot of time asking neuroscientists, what is the theory of the brain going to look like? And the biggest surprise to me was that they didn't have an answer. Try this experiment yourself. Find a neuroscientist and ask them, what will the theory of the brain look like? And when I asked that question, I usually just got kind of a stare. And then some interesting discussion afterwards. But it was clear to me that this is not a kind of question that's frontmost in people's minds. And I think it's probably because the brain is so complex. It's a bit like asking an economist, when we understand the world economy, what will be the theory, what will be the form of the theory? But anyway, I do think about that question, and I think the answer, for the best answer I can come up to for the question of when we understand the brain, what will the answer look like? My best guess is that the answer will look like an artificial intelligence program that functionally performs very similarly to the brain and that is organized by some design principles, and those design principles will also be part of our theory of the brain. For example, that visual processing happens a lot in parallel and so forth. And it's a side effect of executing that artificial intelligence program will also predict the detailed neural activity in the brain. So for me, that would be a large part of what it would mean to have a theory or an understanding of how the brain really works. So it's very closely tied to computer science. They're not distinct fields. And it's very, very closely tied to artificial intelligence. Our AI and cognitive neuroscience will become increasingly close over the next decades.
You somewhat have discussed this already, but what do you see as the current state of brain research and the challenges to this research?
You know, there's been a wonderful explosion of progress since roughly 1995, and that's because around 1995, functional MRI became usable by researchers as a way to measure neural activity in the brain. And by the way, functional fMRI gives you a picture in three dimensions of neural activity down to about 1 millimeter spatial resolution in the brain. So it's a pretty fine-grained measure, you know, spatially pretty fine resolution, until you realize that within 1 cubic millimeter of brain tissue, there are about 10 to the fifth neurons. So it's nowhere near looking down at the single neuron level. It's more looking at like 50,000 or 100,000 neurons at a time. But because of Thomas Kuhn, the philosopher of science, pointed out that many revolutions in at least the empirical sciences happened because of the discovery of new instruments. And that's certainly been the case in cognitive neuroscience. fMRI has been had a huge impact. And more recently, some additional instruments have become available. For example, magnetoencephalography, or MEG scanning, is a different technology for observing human brain activity that has somewhat worse spatial resolution than fMRI. It's a centimeter instead of a millimeter. But it has wonderful time resolution, much better than fMRI. With MEG, you can see down to 1 millisecond the timing of neural activity in the brain. And when you put those two together, you can hope to get both a millimeter spatial resolution and a millisecond time resolution. In fact, in our own studies of language processing, we use both imaging methods together. And one of the interesting machine learning questions is how to take advantage of both of those types of data simultaneously when you train your model. But I think a corollary of this is that if we can come up with that additional instrumentation breakthroughs like those will open up even more visibility into what's going on in the brain. And for non-human brain studies, for example, in, you know, rats, for example, and other non-human animals, people have found, for example, that genetic engineering can be very useful. In fact, there's now a technique available that allows genetically engineering and treating animals so that when their neurons fire, you can make the neurons emit photons, so you can actually see them, see the corollary of the neural firing. And so we, of course, can't do this in humans, but in rats, perhaps we could do that. And so that's another kind of instrumentation that gives us even a finer grain visibility into what's going on. So I think to answer your question about what are the challenges in neuroscience, one dimension there is coming up with even better instruments to measure what's happening in the brain. But that's really not the full answer, because, just to give an example, there's a very simple animal called C. elegans, for which we've had the complete wiring diagram. We know every neuron. There are hundreds of neurons in this. It's a little worm. There are hundreds of neurons. We know every single one. We know the complete wiring diagram. And furthermore, we've known that for 30 years. And yet nobody has a computer program that simulates the behavior of the C. elegans. So just being able to get the wiring diagram and being able to see the data of what's going on is not the same as understanding how that brain is working. And so in addition to the instrumentation challenges and opportunities, it's just as important that we have some breakthroughs in terms of computer science-style process models of what are the computations required or sufficient for executing the behaviors that we see in the animals. So I think it's going to be a very interesting, to me, probably the two main drivers, at least for cognitive neuroscience, will be our ability to come up with even better instruments and to also take advantage of the growing volume of experimental data that exists across labs in the world. And then the second challenge is really to come up with better computer simulations of the cognitive processes themselves. And that's a task that'll be shared between cognitive neuroscience and AI.
And there's quite a few projects already, though, that are duplicating in silicon sort of what's happening in the brain, right? IBM, there's deep learning, there's, I think, work out of UCLA and so on. Isn't that more advanced than sort of mimicking what's in the C. elegans?
It is, in fact, right. So my point about the C. elegans is that having the schematic of the wiring diagram doesn't mean that you can, that you really understand how that brain works. If that were the case, we would have 3 decades ago been able to simulate a C. elegans, and we don't have a simulation of them. But you're right. There is a lot of work going on looking at much more complex cognitive processes. A lot of great work. You're right. IBM has a very ambitious project to try to simulate parts of the brain. You know, one way to kind of slice up the different approaches that are being taken is there's kind of an analogy in brain science to economics in the sense that economists have decided that they want to look both at macroeconomics and microeconomics, right? They're trying to understand how the world economy works. One way is to study individual behavior, microeconomics, and what influences each individual. There are 10 to the 10th of these individuals in the world, so maybe once you understand how each individual behavior is influenced, you can build a simulation of those 10 to the 10th to simulate the world economy. That's the microeconomics approach. The macroeconomics approach, of course, is to look at aggregate behavior. You know, maybe you model countries in terms of how their central bank operations will influence interest rates, for example, and then you at that aggregate level instead of at the individual level, try to model it. Well, it's the same in neuroscience. Not only are there 10 to the 10th people in the world, but there happen to be 10 to the 10th neurons in your brain. And one way to try to study the brain, I'll call it micro neuroscience, is try to model how individual neurons work. And then once you get that and the wiring diagram, put them together to model the brain. But in addition to the micro neuroscience approach, we could also use a kind of macro neuroscience approach, which is pretty much what you get if you use fMRI, and you can't really look at the individual neurons, but only at millimeter cubes of them, which has 10 to the 5th neurons in it. And now, just like in macroeconomics, you're looking at the macro average behavior of collections of neurons and trying to understand how those more aggregate neural averages combine to form the overall behavior. So I think, and there's room for both, you know, just like there's a benefit to doing both microeconomics and macroeconomics, there's a huge benefit in neuroscience doing both micro neuroscience and macro neuroscience and understanding the relation between the two. And I think that's what the field is embarked on. So I think it's in a very healthy state in that sense.
You know, it's interesting that there's all of this work going on, both at a micro and a macro level that you talked about, but in many, many different areas. And ultimately, it gets down to the individual. So what are the implications of all of this happening? What are the future coming advances in mining, for example, personal data?
Wow. I think there are going to be huge changes. So I think the most visible change to us we're already starting to see, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. In terms of personal data, I think the most obvious upcoming change will be in our mobile devices, our cell phones and so forth, because personalization and mining personal data is partly determined by what algorithms you use to mine that data, but it's even more determined by what data is available. And your cell phone has the opportunity to collect more data about you than any other thing on earth, right? Because my cell phone is in my pocket right now, and the GPS device knows that I'm here, knows exactly where I am, and it knows where I was 15 minutes ago and 2 hours ago. The microphone, if it decided to turn itself on, could listen in on this conversation and transcribe it. The camera, if it wasn't in my pocket, could look around the room and see that I'm speaking into this speakerphone. And if you just think about it in terms of data availability, mobile devices are completely dominate in terms of what kind of personalized data can be acquired. Now, right now, they're doing kind of interesting things with that data, but if you think about what could be done, I think it's even much more dramatic. And so just to give an example of what we might see in 10 years, I think there's, well, this is speculation, but it seems to me there are a couple trends that are going to collide and produce really interesting, unpredictable phenomena. One is just the availability of more and more personal data from these mobile devices. Second trend is really technical advances in computer science. So I do believe that within 10 or maybe 15 years, we will have computer programs that can read the web, well, can read in a and understand text in a sense very similar to what you and I today do as humans. So we'll have human level reading of, or near human level reading competence in computers, let's say in 10 years, just to pick a number. Similarly for visual processing and for speech. So if you put those together with the idea that your cell phone has all the right sensors, cameras, microphones, and GPS and accelerometers, and it'll have more in the future too, then those two trends, the availability of the data, the development of machine learning algorithms that can find very subtle patterns in that data, and the growing competence of computer programs in terms of reading, listening, hearing, understanding, seeing, it'll be like, the best way to envision what that will lead to is imagine that you hired me 24 hours a day to just follow you around every single place you went, unless you turned me off with your ignore me now button. But and I followed you around for your entire life that way. I would know so much about you, and you could task me with all kinds of things, right? You could say, you know, I have this conference call today that's going to be recorded. I really need a good speaker phone that has good quality audio. Can you take care of that for me? And I would do it if I were your assistant 24 hours a day. I would just be able to do that for you. Today, we don't have cell phones that we can ask to do that. But in the future, you know, why won't we? So I think learning your personal habits is one part of it. But another equally important part is just the growing competence of programs in terms of perception, speech, text, vision, and others, planning and cognitive competence.
I guess there's a lot of controversy in terms of agencies mining data of governments and people, and even this ability to turn on webcams without even you realizing that it's being turned on. So what does that mean to personal privacy?
It could be a disaster for personal privacy. It could be the end of privacy. It's really a social question, a political question, a society question that we all need to get engaged in. I have my opinion, which is that in a democracy like ours, it's not reasonable to have governments operate collecting data about us secretly without sharing with it, without being upfront about what data they're collecting. That's separate. The question of whether they should or should not collect any given type of data is one question. But a distinct question is, should they or should they not allow society to make the decision about whether they collect that data? My point is, on the second question, I think society needs to make the decision about whether the data gets collected or not. I'm not saying that the government should collect no data. I'm not saying the government should collect every piece of data they possibly can. But I am saying that it's an important social question for us as a society to debate and come to a resolution on. And I think it's just wrong-headed policy to think that the government, some small set of people compared to all of society, should make those decisions and not inform the rest of us about what the decision is. I think that's just not a tenable, sustainable system. It will lead to all of us deciding, becoming more paranoid that everything we do is being tracked, and it's just not a sustainable way for society to operate. The only sustainable way I can imagine is that we actually have an open discussion, come to some resolution about what data government should and should not be collecting, and then some way of enforcing to make sure that, in fact, is what our government is doing.
And I guess we can extrapolate on what you talked about earlier. You know, let's say we have a 10 to the 5th higher resolution and fMRIs, and the same kind of increase in resolution, but with the temporal aspect that you talked about with MEGs, mm-hmm. and a cloud-based AI system that can sort of reason what's happening. So now we have walking entities with embedded devices, and we can read each other's thoughts, and we can anticipate what they're thinking. What does that mean?
Wow. Now that's, to be honest, that's pretty far off unless there's some miracle instrument devised. So right now the fMRI scanner that we use weighs about 10 tons. So you're not going to walk around with this. And similarly, the MEG scanner is a big super-cooled magnet, and you have to sit in a chair with your head stuck inside this. So it's not a portable device. We won't have people walking around with that in the near term. But I think the idea that we'll have our brains instrumented at that level of detail in our routine life, that can't happen unless there's some new breakthrough that we haven't seen coming. But I do think that we all underestimate the rate of technological advance, and I think one of the most underestimated upcoming disruptive technologies is really that computers will learn to read. And think about that for a second, what that really means. So right now, what do computers do? Well, we have search engines, and computers are very good at finding some word, and you type in a word or a phrase, and they'll find web pages that contain that. But, you know, you could do that too, by hand, in languages that you don't understand. If I gave you a collection of Swahili web pages and a Swahili phrase, you could tediously look through those pages and find the Swahili phrase, tell me which pages contain it. But it wouldn't mean that you understand those pages. What I'm talking about is the fact that today, to search engines, all the web looks like it's written in Swahili. They still can find the tokens and return us the pages, but those computer programs do not currently understand the content of the text that they're returning to us. That, I believe, is going to change. The Nell Research Project is one of a variety of research projects moving in that direction. There's a huge amount of resources going into that from government funding, but maybe even more importantly, corporate funding, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, you name it, IBM, many of the large internet companies are putting huge effort into computer reading. So let's assume, for the sake of argument, that in 10, maybe 15 years, if you want to be more conservative, computers reach the stage where we could give them the morning newspaper, the front page of the morning newspaper, and they could read and understand that well enough to provide a one-sentence summary of each article, let's say. And furthermore, if they were in our cell phone and knew all of our interests, they could even build a personalized version of that newspaper for us, given what they know is our interest and our upcoming activities for today. Now, that's kind of interesting, but now think of it this way. When computers learn to read like that, they won't be constrained the way you and I are. I can read one, maybe three, if I really put my energy into it, up to three newspapers a day. Computers will read it all. When computers read, they will just read it all. They're very fast, and we can have them process every newspaper on Earth. They can read. They will be able to read the entire web. There are hundreds of billions or more web pages out there. If we read one page, if we read 100 web pages per day for our entire life, that would be 36,000 web pages per year, 3.5 million web pages during our entire lifetime, if we read 100 web pages a day. But there are hundreds of billions, and computers will be able to read it all. So they will be more, once they learn to read, computers will be more well-read than we ever could be, just because they'll be able to read it all and we won't. And so that's a very disruptive technology, because what it means is right now the web is the world's knowledge base for human consumption. It's in text, and so we write it in text for each other, and that's a great idea. Right now it's inaccessible to computers, but once computers learn to read, that web will become the biggest knowledge base accessible to computers. And then what will we want to do with that? Well, one thing I want is I will want a personal reader. I want my computer program, once it can learn to read, I want it to become my personal reader, and every day to just scan all of the new stuff that's appearing on the web and in the newspapers and on the blogs and in Twitter, and produce the digest. And to the degree that it knows about my personal tasks and interests and priorities and preferences, I want it to customize that digest to help me achieve the tasks that I'm working on today. And so, for example, I'm going to tell that computer program, hey, I'm interested in cognitive neuroscience, and in particular, how brains understand language. Here's what I currently understand. Read my papers that I've written. I'll give my papers to the program. I'll say, read these. And then I'll say to it, now, go out there and tell me if there's anything that's in conflict with what I'm saying in those papers. Go out there and tell me if there's some new paper that comes out that answers one of the open questions in my papers. And it'll be a reading assistant with a kind of competence that's not humanly feasible just because of the volume.
And I guess there's the predictive analytics sort of portion of this. You know, there's various models of the stock market, and you take the leading one and you can say, examine all the world trends in terms of these 60 variables and give me some kind of conclusions of what's emergent. Or it's like, you know, Google or Bing or some of the other search engines. You can predict activities that are going to occur in disease just by emergent sort of news occurring in a particular region. So what does that mean to the economy?
Yeah. I get that the top, I agree with your point that, which I would say maybe this way, that the more real-time data we can get, the better we can become, with the help of computers, at predicting the future, the next time point, maybe the next day, maybe the next week, who knows. But, you know, and it's always been that way. If I see a video where somebody's walking down the street and you ask me to predict what the next frame in the video will look like, I'll predict that they're a little further down the street. So it's not magic that when there are irregularities, we can predict the future. It's just that suddenly with the advent of these huge volumes of real-time data, we can predict the future for things much more interesting and subtle than a person walking down the street and what will the next frame look like. Like you say, maybe we can predict for the world economy what the next framework will look like. So I guess the implications of that for the world economy, the economists would probably say, is it'll lead to a more productive economy, because if you can see what's coming next, you can more efficiently plan for it and produce what needs to be available for that upcoming future instead of being in the dark about what's needed. It'll certainly mean that data has huge value, and that the ability to do that analysis and make those predictions has huge value. And it will raise a societal level question about who has access to that huge value, right? Will it be, for example, that some private company collects this data and has it and can make the predictions and the rest of us can't, and that company gets the huge value? Or will we as a society say, no, the data is like the interstate highway system. It needs to be available to everybody, like the internet. It needs to be available to everybody so that we all can benefit from that data, and we can all have an opportunity to think of a new way to use that data. So I think the question that you raise leads immediately to this question of access to that data and whether that will be private or public. That'll be a very important question for us all.
You know, earlier I mentioned that, you know, imagine a world where you have a portable, perhaps embedded, fMRI that has a, you know, 10 to the fifth better resolution, or a, or an MEG that's sort of similar, but it also has this temporal impact. But we're saying that there's nothing available today that even suggests that such could exist. But then we have something like D-Wave Systems, you know, they have a commercial quantum computer and have had it for a number of years. So now NASA has invested in it with Google, and I guess other sort of research organizations have now bought into it. And that's because this year there's some evidence from research universities indicating that there's something here. We can see quantum effects being utilized in this commercial computer. And yet if you talk to computer scientists, a lot of them say, well, a quantum computer is really 50 years out. And yet today there's a computer that's being used commercially. So perhaps something very disruptive will appear, and we just can't forecast it at this point.
You're right. I think Ray Kurzweil is right when he says that we're just always too conservative when we try to predict the pace of technological change, right? Just go back to 1990. Who saw the internet coming? Who saw the web coming? Who saw brain imaging coming? And that was just 1990, 20 years ago.
Exactly. And in fact, I'm going to ask a question about Kurzweil, but I just want to get some sort of housekeeping done. And the housekeeping is that throughout this interview, you talked about machine learning, but there's people in the audience who may not really sort of fully realize what machine learning is. So can you talk more generally, what is machine learning and where it's headed and how it will impact us all?
Sure. Machine learning is a part of computer science. You can think of every field defined by some question, right? Like physics tries to answer the question, what are the laws that govern the physical world? Machine learning tries to answer the following question. How can we build computer programs that automatically improve through experience? So there are a lot of examples of that. A spam filter is a good example of that. You probably have a spam filter. Almost surely that spam filter was trained using machine learning. It's trained by giving it examples. Here's an email that I consider to be spam. Here's a different email that I consider to not be spam. Here's another one label, and so forth. So providing, so machine learning includes the algorithms that are used to train classifiers like spam filters. Spam filter gets trained by showing it examples of emails that you label as positive and negative examples of spam. And what the machine learning algorithms do is they look through many of those examples and they find the subtle features that distinguish spam from not spam, or they find the subtle features that similarly distinguish which historical medical patients responded well to this treatment versus that treatment. Or they learn which historical credit card transactions turned out later to be fraudulent versus legitimate. And those are all examples. The credit card fraud, spam, medical diagnosis and treatment are all examples where machine learning today is in fairly widespread use. And so it's really in part, one aspect of machine learning is to use large historical data sets like those and to use them to essentially train decision makers to classify future examples. But another kind of learning is what you see in these self-driving cars, for example, which learn to control themselves by roaming around in the world. And they learn a variety of things. For example, they learn as they're driving down the road, they might see something far ahead and might not be able to identify what that thing is in the road. But once they drive ahead in another 30 seconds and they're right next to that thing, they can see, oh, it's a bicycle. But now they can use that data, oh, it's a bicycle. They could use that to go back to what that image looked like 30 seconds ago, and they can self-label for themselves. Oh, that indistinct thing on the horizon, I later found out that was a bicycle. So must be, here's a training example of what a bicycle looks like from a distance. And so there, machine learning doesn't just mean using historical pre-collected data. It can also mean as you go through the world or over time, using what you now understand to go back and train yourself so that in the future you'll be able to anticipate better. And so, roughly speaking, machine learning is about getting computers to improve with experience, but that includes a lot of different aspects.
So how do you feel as a leading proponent of machine learning, you know, somebody who's recognized worldwide as a thought leader and as a researcher in this area? You must feel like you're a kid in a candy shop or something.
I do. To be honest, I do think that machine learning is the fastest growing part of computer science this century. That's what it looks like to me. So if you really think about the evolution of computer science as a field, it's not that old a field. Maybe it started somewhere around 1950. So it's a 60-year-old field. It's not very old. And what are the rough historical stages of computer science? Well, in the 1950s, people realized, hey, machines can calculate things. And then they started doing that and finding what kind of calculations machines could do. In the 60s and 70s, they came up with the idea that, oh, we can program these with high-level languages. We don't have to do it in terms of ones and zeros and put bits in as the computer instructions. We can use things like Fortran or Algol or eventually Java and beyond. Computer languages, high-level languages. And that was sort of the next historical stage in computers was, oh, we can give them capabilities by programming them not at the level of ones and zeros, but programming them instead, telling them what to do in these much more convenient languages that have statements like if and then and loops like while this is true, do this. But then around the 80s and 90s, two things happened. One was all of the easy algorithms got written. What do I mean by that? What I mean is, there are certain kind of basic things you want computers to be able to do. Multiply matrices together, or add numbers, or find the shortest path in a graph, or so forth. And there were books, like Don Knuth's books on algorithms, that got discovered in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, how you do these things. How do you find the shortest path through a graph? How do you most efficiently multiply matrices? What if they're sparse? And there was a whole industry of making up good algorithms for commonly needed subproblems. Well, that was a great thing, too, and that was the stage of computer science that we've kind of saturated on. There aren't many papers now telling us how to better multiply matrices. But then there were these things that we knew how to do, but we couldn't write. We could do them ourselves, but we couldn't write down a program to do them. Like, we can recognize our mother when she walks into the room, but that doesn't mean we can write a computer program to recognize our mother, unlike matrix multiplication, which we can write down the recipe for. So machine learning is really just the current answer to the next natural question about computation, which is, well, what about those things that we can't write down the recipe for, recognizing our mother? Can we get a computer to do that? Well, not if we have to write down the recipe, because we don't know the recipe, even though we have the competence. Well, what if instead we just show the picture of our mother to the computer and a picture of somebody else, and we'll just label a bunch of pictures. Here's my mother. This picture does not contain my mother. And it turns out machine learning is the method of choice for developing software of that type. So when I look at the history of computer science, I see that we've kind of saturated in terms of the recipes that we can write by hand for many problems. And now we have a lot of problems that we know how to label data. We can do the task ourselves, but we don't know the recipe. We don't know the algorithm. We can't write it down. And a lot of these problems are things like computer vision problems, where we can do human vision, but we can't say how to recognize our mom. Or speech recognition, or reading text, or analyzing brain image data. These are all things that we don't really quite know the recipe for, and so machine learning becomes the method of choice. Even analyzing medical records you know, we can do that to some degree, but it, well, let's take a different example, credit card fraud detection. That's a very important problem economically. The method of choice these days is to just get millions of historical credit card transactions and let a machine learning algorithm figure out what is the subtle pattern that distinguishes fraud from legitimate transactions. And so there are just more and more examples of these valuable computations where we don't know the recipe. We cannot write down the algorithm by hand. And so machine learning is the method of choice for developing that software. For that reason, and because of the growing volume of online data that makes it many of these problems closer to perception problems and to formal problems, I think machine learning has a very bright future. I don't think, by the way, that machine learning is the solved problem by any means. I think we're still in the very early, young days of the field of machine learning. And when we look back in 25 years at the algorithms that we're using today, we'll kind of smile in a bemused way at how primitive some of them are.
So the next question is, again, taking a more broader view, and that is, where is artificial intelligence heading, and why should the public care?
I find it hard to think about artificial intelligence at a technical level independent of thinking about machine learning. So I think it's become an important component of artificial intelligence. Ah, let me answer it this way. So just like we said that machine learning was, as a field, we should understand what it is by understanding what question it's trying to answer. In the case of machine learning, that question was, how can we build computer programs that automatically improve with experience? Some would say the artificial intelligence defining question is, how do we build computers that are as intelligent as we are? When I think about the future of artificial intelligence, I think they're already more intelligent than I am in a lot of ways, and they're stupider than I am in a lot of ways. They're more intelligent in that they can already multiply matrices or even do simple arithmetic much faster and more accurately than I can. So computers have already surpassed me in that. Apparently, they can also play chess better than I can. But they can't play music as well as I do, and they can't windsurf as well as I do. Maybe the future of artificial intelligence, one way to think about it is, which of our competences that we currently perform better than computers, which of those will computers be able to take on, and which of those do we want computers to do for us? I'm not actually that interested in a computer windsurfer. I wouldn't buy one. I wouldn't be that interested in, I don't know, surfing with one. But I would be interested in a computer that could read the web for me and help me find the journal articles that I should also be reading and help me summarize those journal articles to move forward my research faster. So I think one way to think about the future of artificial intelligence is to give some thought to what kind of assistance would we like, and what are the feasible types of assistance that we might be able to get computers to provide.
We can extrapolate further again upon that and say, let's embody that machine learning algorithm into a robot that's mobile and that's dexterity. And I can windsurf with that. That robot can be a companion. And let's now create synthetic skin so that's almost indistinguishable from a human being. So it could help the elderly. It could raise our children. It could be a tutor. It could help me in my daily chores. I mean, I guess it's just endless where it could go. If you can embody some of this in a mobile platform that has arms and legs. I guess now the really broad question is, where is computer science heading?
Computer science, you know, maybe one way to see where it's heading is to see how our conception of computer science is different from what it was in the early days. I think computer science, to me, one of the big changes in our perception of computer science is, in the early days, we really thought of computer science as a field that was about getting machines to calculate things. And I think now, when we think about computer technology, we think just as much of communication as we think of calculation. The internet is really about communication and calculation, both. and marrying the two. We also think now about computation more generally than just machines. For example, much of the recent work on crowdsourcing is really thinking about how to organize humans, teams of humans, to jointly calculate the answer to some larger question. So those are two directions that I think computer science has matured into, right? Thinking more about communication in addition to calculation. And thinking about computation as not something that has to be done necessarily just with transistors. So I think the future scientifically of computer science is to become really a field of computation and thinking of how computations can be done by machines, by humans, by teams of the two, by organizations, and just the whole field of computation that thought more broadly. Similarly, machine learning, I think the future of, the distant future of machine learning is to drop the first word. Much of the theory of machine learning that tells us how much data will be necessary for a learner to examine in order to acquire some concept at a certain level of accuracy. That's what our theories of machine learning currently tell us. But those theories, if you think about it and look at them in detail, they apply just as well to human learning and to organizational learning and to evolution. So I think maybe just as we started thinking about computation as calculation, maybe we started thinking about machine learning as getting computers to improve and understanding in terms of information theory what's feasible and not. Maybe the future there is also to look at other learning systems.
You know, when you talked about crowdsourcing, I guess it kind of brings to mind this folded game where, you know, where they analyze how proteins fold into enzymes, and you can crowdsource this out to even kids, and they can solve problems that supercomputers and teams of computer scientists can't.
Right.
So it's really the combination of the two, and they can do it in a few weeks.
Right.
Or this game EverQuest, you know, it's an online game, but you can model economic behavior because there's millions of people out there. Or, you know, I think you used this as well, the Amazon's Mechanical Turk.
Anyway. Yes. Yes, in fact, I think the whole, that whole line of work on crowdsourcing and has many interesting dimensions that are going to be even more important in the future. So, for example, as you mentioned, the Foldit game, which lets any of us participate in a game that whose result as a community is designing, I guess it's understanding protein folding better. So we're actually contributing to a scientific objective and making scientific progress as a side effect of playing that game. The idea that volunteerism, the face of volunteerism, could change dramatically. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who would be very happy to be volunteers if they believed that they were, their time was going to be used productively for something. And if it's, if we make it possible for people when they have 15 spare minutes to play a game like Foldit and contribute to an important scientific advance, then it just changes the cost-benefit equation when people are trying to decide what to do with their time. So I think that alone is very interesting. If you look in a second direction, if you look at Amazon's Mechanical Turk service, they call it, where you hire people to do short, very short tasks, like we use Mechanical Turk, for example, to have people evaluate some of the beliefs that our NEL system is reading from the web so that we can get feedback to NEL and so that we can measure its accuracy. But if you think of the future of even a service like Mechanical Turk, where currently those are very simple short-term tasks, you might make, say, 5 or 10 cents for labeling a belief that NEL has come up with and labeling that correct or not. And you might do 100 of those an hour, and so the tasks are very fine-grained. But maybe the future is that Mechanical Turk is just the very first step in what will become an online job clearing center. What if the future, maybe the future of jobs is that instead of working for company X 40 hours a week, we will log into the future replacement for Mechanical Turk and shop around for interesting jobs to do for the next week and put together a team of people who can do that job for the next week. For example, maybe to write a particular computer program for a particular new mobile device that's coming out. And so instead of having currently Mechanical Turk, which has shown that for simple tasks, you can actually match up the people who need the task done with the people who are out there with time to do it and handle the payments. Well, in the future, maybe that will become much more sophisticated kind of tasks that are not things you do in 5 seconds, but things that you do in a couple of weeks and where you have to put together the right team of people. I wonder if maybe the future is that many of us will not be working 40 hours a week at a particular company, but instead we'll just be logging in and putting together these teams on demand to do interesting things and take advantage of the specialized competence that each of us has.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had an interview with Kishore Swaminathan, who founded all the research labs for Accenture, Accenture being its, I guess the largest service company. But he talked about that. He talked about the world's going to be without borders because of the internet, and that people aren't going to work for any company for any length of time, but they're just going to work on projects. And as you indicated, sort of bid on different projects, and that's what you're going to do. Your life could consist of a week on one project, a week on another. And in essence, you're going to work on for many different kinds of organizations. And in fact, he even indicated that organizational boundaries are going to disappear. Country boundaries are going to disappear. And everything's going to be organized through the internet in some way. So it's the social disruption that's going to occur. I mean, it's kind of interesting where this is all heading. Now, this next question is about Judeo Pearl. And so what are your views on Judeo Pearl's work? I mean, he on Bayesian networks, and then he got into counterfactuals, and now he's created this sort of a causal calculus, right? He's codified or created a mathematical way of representing causality. And what are your views on that work and its implications to what you're doing?
I think it's great work. Judea's work is great, and there are a variety of other people working in this field of trying to infer causality as well. I think it's great work, and it's very interesting work, because one of the key difficulties, honestly, in machine learning is that machine learning programs are quite good at finding correlations between variables, but quite bad at determining which of those correlations are actually causal. So, for example, I might have a program that discovers that if I'm making a transaction on my credit card for a small amount of money at a gas station that I've never been to before, then that's an indicator that maybe this is a fraudulent credit card. Somebody might have stolen my credit card, and they're testing it at a gas station to make sure it works before they have to go face a human with that credit card. But the program might find that correlation, that it correlates with fraudulent behavior, but it doesn't understand the causal explanation that I just gave for it. And so one of the challenges for machine learning is really to move on beyond correlation to be able to infer causation too. And I think the kind of theoretical work and formalisms that Pearl and others are developing are really great in that direction. Sadly, though, it turns out, I think that while those formalisms give us a better handle on what it means to infer causality, it doesn't actually make it easy. They're not finding easier ways to infer causality. They're just so far telling us more precisely what it means to infer causality and just how difficult it is to do it in terms of the data that you have to have available. But I think it's great research. It's an important fundamental direction for the whole field.
But, Judea, I guess, ultimately started off as an engineer, so he always looks at the sort of the practical implications of his work. And That's why he's always creating these, in this last case, sort of a mathematical notation and graphical way of representing causal relationships. Can't that be put into a computer through algorithms?
It can, but much of what those theories show is that it's impossible to infer causality unless you can actively get additional measurements. And so, for example, if we go to a historical database of credit card transactions or a historical database of medical records, we might still be unable to infer causality from those because what it takes to determine causality as opposed to correlation is to be able to go in and control some variable. So, for example, we might know that white blood cell count is a good predictor of whether you have an infection, but the causal explanation of that is very subtle, and it involves, you know, the immune system reacting to some invading organism and then therefore creating white blood cells because they have some properties that allow you to fight off the bacteria. So if the only thing that my medical record has in it is the white blood cell count of these many patients and whether they had an infection, it's still not telling me whether, white blood cells cause the infection or the infection causes the white blood cells. To go in, I have to resolve that, I have to go in and do an intervention and change one of those two variables and see whether that leads to a change in the second variable. So I'm not saying that it's impractical, but I am saying that to date, what those theories have told me is that if you want to distinguish correlation from causation, then it's going to be important for our computer programs in the future to have a greater capability than they have now to go in and do interventions and to do controlled experimentation, changing the value of some variable so that they can measure whether the other variable changes or not. And in a practical way, I think then, you know, it's common sense that that's what you're going to have to do in order to understand causality. And I think these formal frameworks are helping us get a more precise grip on that common sense intuition.
Now, earlier you talked about Kurzweil and some really interesting thinking from Kurzweil. In fact, he's been hired by Google, right? So I thought
that was an
interesting move. What are your views on Kurzweil's singularity? Because isn't there a tie-in with the work you're doing?
Well, there is, but one thing I have to say about Ray Kurzweil is I have a lot of respect for his comment that people routinely underestimate the rate of technical advance. I think he's dead on that. When it comes to the singularity, which I take this singularity hypothesis as something like there will come a time when computers are more intelligent than people, and what's going to happen then? It'll be a very different world. To me, that seems a little bit, it seems to me to be the wrong way to even phrase the issue. So I would say instead of singularity, we should think about a multilarity, right? Let me ask you right now, are computers more intelligent than us or not? Or are we more intelligent than computers? And the answer is computers are more intelligent than us at certain things, and we are more intelligent than computers at other things. So there's not a single singularity. There's not a single notion of are computers more or less intelligent than I am. They are more intelligent than me when it comes to play chess. Every time I try to play a chess program, it beats me. I'm tired of it. But they're not as good as I am at doing research in machine learning. Or doing brain science. So the whole idea that there's a single question to ask, are they smarter than us or dumber than us, is, I think, misguided. And we should replace the singularity notion by multilarity and just say it's not an all or nothing or a one or zero kind of question. There's a whole vector of different competences. And computers are better than us at some, worse than us at others, and over time, I don't think computers are going to get stupider over time. I don't think people are either. But I do think that computers will become better than us at more and more of those things. But I think that's actually the more interesting way to think of it instead of pretending that there's a single notion of intelligence. I think that does a lot of disservice to the discussion to pretend that there's a single notion of computers being intelligent or not.
Oh, that's an interesting sort of response to the question. I guess then it sort of ties into this, you know, Gardner's seven intelligences, or perhaps more, or Bloom's taxonomy, you know, of sort of this different levels of understanding, or you know, this four levels of competence.
Right, and there are many systems like that, many taxonomies. And if you work bottom up, then you can make a list of competences that computers have that are better and worse than humans right now. And you can track how that's changed over the last 10, 20, 30 years. And you could try to extrapolate how it will change in the future. I think that's an interesting discussion. But, you know, it's going to be a long time before every single competence will be dominated by computers. And the question of whether computers will take over the world, I honestly think that we need to put more thought about that. And again, at the level of society, even though we're nowhere near computers taking over the world, we are making decisions one by one. And again, this comes back to why I don't like the idea of the singularity. It pretends that there's just one event that we have to think about, which is computers becoming too intelligent. That's not it. It's really multilarity. We've already apparently made the decision that it's okay for drone computers, drone aircraft under computer control, to kill people. That's a big decision. There's human interaction with those drones, but it seems to me that people who are concerned about the singularity should instead be thinking in terms of multilarity and different competences and individual questions of the form, do we want computers to have weapons on their robot bodies and be able to use those weapons? Is that what we want? That's different from the question of do we want computers to take over the world, but it's a much more immediate and I think a much more important question for us to be thinking about.
You know, I have this question on robots and free will, but earlier you sort of gave this idea, you know, you have to first define free will. So let's maybe put it this way, where a robot is indistinguishable from a human being and that it's a mobile entity and really will be indistinguishable in terms of its actions and reactions and its ability to forecast and have introspection and assign credit and blame and so on. So when will robots have free will in that sense? And what does free will mean? But I'm saying in the sense of a human being.
Yeah, I have to say, I still have a problem with that term. I mean, I think computers make decisions and we can give them the ability and the command to make certain types of decisions. Going back to the, you know, robot vehicle deciding whether to run the yellow light or stop now. If we write the computer program in a way that defines the problem as make sure you don't go through a red light, then we are implicitly also giving the robot the authority to make the decision about what to do in the case of a yellow light, because we haven't told it. And we have told it to not go through red lights, but we haven't said anything about yellow or green. And so as it learns how to go down the street but not go through red lights, it will have to learn to make decisions about what to do about those yellow lights. And so in that sense, we've given it, I'm not sure I want to use the term free will, but we've given it the responsibility and the authority to make the yellow light decision. And if we don't want to give it that authority, then we should instead write the program that says, you know, don't go through yellow lights or red lights. And now it doesn't have the authority or the responsibility to make that decision because that was instead one of its innate programmer-defined goals that it's trying to learn to achieve. So, again, for me, I'm not sure about how to precisely define free will, but I am sure how to think about giving computers the responsibility to learn to achieve goals, and then the difference between giving to the computer an explicit and fixed goal for it to learn to achieve versus the other decisions that it will have to make and learn to make well in order to achieve those goals.
Now, can you profile what you consider to be your top research successes? And it could be one, two, or three of them, and what value they provide to research, and then the broader implications and applications to business and the computing industry.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Let's see. I think, honestly, so at a technical level, within the field of machine learning, I think one of the results that we've come up with that has that I'm most happy about is the idea of how to get computers to learn from unlabeled data. So, for example, we were talking a little bit earlier about training a spam classifier, where I say, oh, here's an email and I'll label this one as spam. Here's a different email. I'll label this one as not spam. Similarly, I could, you know, learn to classify web pages according to is this one, interesting to me or not, so forth. In machine learning, we call that supervised training because it requires that some person label these training examples so that the program can then learn to label it them future ones. So one of the technical results that we've come up with that I think is that I'm happy about is we ask the question, in what cases could unlabeled data also be useful? Like, what if I'm training a spam filter, to take an example? What if I have some labeled examples of spam and not spam, but then I just have a whole lot of other emails that aren't even labeled? In what cases could we expect unlabeled data to be useful for a learner, you know, in the sense that it would actually improve its ability to label spam? And at first it seemed like a crazy idea, like what good could it possibly be to have unlabeled emails? But it turns out, provably, there are cases where it's useful. And even spam filters could be one of them. And the key idea has to do with there's a formal structure of the learning problem where there's redundant information available. And, for example, in the case of spam filter, maybe I could look at the words in the body of the email, you know, if it's offering me an opportunity to transfer $1.2 million from some country to my bank account, that could be an indicator of whether it's spam or not. But quite independently of the words that are in the email, there could also be the header information. Who is this email being sent to? Who is it from? What's the subject line? What's the trail of internet ports that it went through in order to reach my inbox? And I could train two classifiers instead of one. I could train one that looks just at the words in the email. I could train a second one that looks just at the header information. And it turns out that this is some joint work with Avram Blum, my colleague here at Carnegie Mellon. We were able to develop some theory and algorithms that showed that if, in fact, you have this kind of situation where you can train two classifiers, in the case of spam, that would be one on the body of the email and one on the header information, and where both of those classifiers actually have, there's enough information in the header and separately in the body to make the decision if you only learned the right function, then it turns out if those two pieces of information are conditionally independent, given the actual label, then you can prove and come up with an algorithm that, in fact, does use the unlabeled data to boost the accuracy of the classifier that you're training. So that turns out to be a very widely usable idea. Once you get the idea that, oh, redundancy, having two different sets of features, in the case of spam, that was the words in the body of the email plus the header. But if I have two different types of information, then, in fact, I can use unlabeled data and an algorithm called co-training, in which these two classifiers that you're training label data for one another and drive themselves toward consistent labeling of the unlabeled data, and that actually helps improve learning. Now, it turns out that's the basis for much of why NEL, our never-ending language learner, actually works, because mostly NEL has to work on unlabeled data. It's mostly just text that's out there on the web, and nobody has labeled for NEL, the idea that, chair is a type of furniture. Nobody, it's just chair appears out there. And so just like in the case of spam, when Nell has to classify an arbitrary noun phrase instead of an arbitrary email and tell whether it refers to, let's say, a city or not, then just like in the case of spam where we could train two classifiers, one looking at the words in the body and one looking at the header, in the case of classifying a noun phrase, Nell also trains multiple classifiers. One of them looks at the phrases around the noun phrase. And for example, if it's trying to classify the noun phrase Pittsburgh to decide whether it's a city or not, if it sees mayor of Pittsburgh, then it will use the fact that it was mayor of X and say, then X probably is a city. Pittsburgh probably is a city because I see mayor of Pittsburgh. That's one classifier. But the other one ignores all those phrases and instead looks at the letter string, the character string, P-I-T-T-S-B-U-R-G. And it notices that the last letters are Berg, B-U-R-G-H, Pittsburgh, Harrisburg. Oh, Berg tends to be the end characters of a noun phrase that's a city. And so the letter string, the character string, and the phrases around the noun phrase are two redundant sources of information that Nell gets to use. And our co-training algorithm is actually underneath Nell and allows it to use this unlabeled data to learn that, in fact, to co-train the classifier that's looking at letter strings to decide what type of noun phrase is this, and the second phrase-based classifier that's looking at properties of the noun phrase in a different way. Maybe I went into a little more detail than planned there, but that's a very useful idea, both theoretically and in practice, for how unlabeled data, and we have a lot of that compared to the smaller amount of labeled data. So it's really an idea about how to use unlabeled data to achieve better accuracy in learning. If you ask me for what were a couple, I think the work that we've been able to do introducing machine learning as a method for analyzing brain image data, is a result that I'm happy with, both in terms of what it's been able to tell us about fundamental questions about how the brain represents meanings of words. And for example, the fact that your brain and mine have very similar neural representations for those. But also just the idea that machine learning could be a useful way to practice cognitive neuroscience. The idea, if you look at the way we're using machine learning there in neuroscience, basically we're using machine learning to train classifiers of brain activity, and those trained classifiers, for example, the one that looks at the brain activity and decides whether you're thinking about a building or a tool, those trained classifiers are effectively virtual sensors of the mental state of the person that sense their mental state when the only thing visible is their neural activity. And that idea has been picked up by more widely in the neuroscience community now. And so it leads to, the ability to, for example, look at other kind of neural activity to decide, has the person made the decision or not made the decision about whether to press the button here? And so for any given thing that you have labeled data for, a neural image and did they press the button or not, or a neural image and were they reading the word hammer or not, you can train a classifier, and effectively that then gives you a virtual new instrument, a virtual sensor of whatever mental state you've trained on. I think that's a kind of result that we're still the field is still exploring how widely useful that can be for cognitive neuroscience. But I think just the very idea of introducing machine learning there is quite interesting, and we're still trying to understand how broadly useful that will be.
Yeah, that work is fascinating. So can you now predict what you consider to be your future successes? And this could be one, two, or three. And then how they will be realized to the general audience.
Well, it's hard to predict success, but I can tell you what my five-year goal is. my five-year goal really is to put together what are now these two distinct research projects that my teams are working on. One is in the area of brain science, studying human language processing. The other is in the area of computer science and machine learning, studying how to get a computer to process language. And these two projects grew up kind of independently, but my five-year goal is really to have them integrate, and the result should be a computer program that both understands the text that you show it and, as a side effect of that, predicts the neural activity in the brain when a person reads that very same text. And the reason that's important to me as a goal is it would represent a new paradigm, a new way of trying to build theories of how the brain works. If it worked, it would also be a new, hopefully, advance in the field of natural language understanding by computers as well. But to me, as we discussed a little bit earlier, what it means to understand the brain is in part to have a model of the sub-steps, the processing steps the brain goes through, and its neural representations that are used along the way. And so the five-year goal of having a computer program that can both understand text itself and make the prediction based on the processes it goes through of what the brain will go through, to me is a big goal, and a lot of my day-to-day work right now is really targeted in that direction. I think more broadly for the field, I hope it will be a success, but one of the, I think maybe success is the wrong word, but one of the real challenges, one of the things that I think will determine how broadly useful machine learning is to society is dealing with the question of privacy and access to data. And I think the technology of machine learning, the computer algorithms that use data to find trends and make predictions, I think that's partly here, and more of that is coming, and I'm very optimistic about the ability of the field to come up with even more powerful learning algorithms in the future. So on that, I'm pretty optimistic. And therefore, it seems to me the limiting factor in terms of what we as a society will gain from this machine learning technology will depend a lot more on the data itself. The algorithms will be there, but access to data by all of us and dealing with the very important privacy issues and whether we want to, what data we want to provide and don't want to provide access to, and maybe some new technical solutions to that question where in a field where, which some people call privacy-enhancing data mining, where maybe we don't have to share all of the data in a central repository, but we still could gain the benefits of the data by passing around the program instead of passing around the data. But generally, I think that whole question of how we're going to deal with privacy and whether access to data will be private or public and what society will do with that is a great interest of mine, because I think it's going to be the determining factor of how much we gain from this technology.
Now, Tom, you have a leadership role in that you chair your department there at Carnegie Mellon. So can you profile some past leadership roles, including your current role, what you see as the value they provide to research in your leadership role, and then the implications of the applications to, you know, the broader marketplace, business, and industry, and so on?
Well, I would say one of the things that I enjoy very much about chairing the machine learning department here is that it gives me an opportunity to see and to interact with people on the outside who are interested primarily in our students and in some of the technologies that we're developing. And I've been able to learn a lot in this position about not only what are the different technical and scientific problems that people in our department are working on, But just as importantly, what are the things that we're doing and not doing that are of interest to, most interest to people outside of the department who are intrigued in our, in what we're doing and interested in our students. It turns out that just a month ago, we had our once every 5 years, external visiting committee, which comes in. It's a team of, 8 experts who come in and, examine the department and make some recommendations. And it was interesting there, we're still awaiting the final report, but the informal feedback included some interesting things. In general, they were happy that the department was flourishing, but they gave some pointers to some directions that they felt were ways in which we could make an even bigger contribution. And one of the, for example, issues that came up focused on the difference between what a university academic department can do and what industry is doing in this area. So, for example, if you think of a company like Google, they actually have huge computational resources and huge data sets, much larger than we have here in the university, right? We don't have all that Google data. We don't have the computer resources they have. And yet they need to hire people who are going to advance their state of the art. That was one of the directions that the external committee, you know, wanted us to think more about how we could match up what we can do in the university to training the kinds of people that industry needs. A different direction that I found, I think it is really important not just to me as chair of the machine learning department, but important to all researchers in machine learning, really, because of the fact that big data is a hot topic right now, and deservedly so, because of the, you know, quickly growing volume of online data sets and questions about what intelligence agencies should be doing and questions about privacy, questions about what we want computers to do and not. Those are all increasingly important questions across all of society. And I think one of the responsibilities that we have as leaders in the field of machine learning is to take those questions on as serious questions, both in terms of helping the public understand what machine learning technology can and cannot do, and what the implications are, so that we can help society as a whole come to good decisions about how to deal with these questions of, you know, should the government be collecting this data? Should we keep it private? Should we let people know? What are the capabilities they have? Do they really need to collect every phone record, or can they just collect the 3 they need? Those are very complicated questions that have partly social political answers, but the trade-offs there, for example, between security and privacy, really have a technical component too. You can change the trade-offs. It's not the case that you either have privacy or we give every piece of data to a secret agency and then we have security. There's a trade-off there. But that trade-off itself can be shifted if we can make some advances in this area of privacy-enhancing data mining. And I think, so back to the main point, I think part of the responsibility of machine learning researchers is to actually engage those questions, because it is machine learning technology that's going to play a huge role in raising those questions, but also can play a big role in being part of the solution to those questions. And in either case, we need to play a bigger role than we currently are in helping everybody in the public understand what the technology can and cannot do today and in the future.
You know, it's interesting then, you know, you have this leadership role as chair of this very important department, and you have this, you know, you're one of the leading experts in the world and a noted researcher and authority. Do you ever think about commercialization of that work?
I do. There are many commercial opportunities. I've been involved. I am involved in small ways in a number of companies. At the same time, I decided some time ago that I guess I'm an academic at heart, and that for me, I really, really, really enjoy the life of the university, in part because even though you can do wonderful things with this technology in companies, and I admire people who are doing that, there are benefits also of doing work at a university. And one of the benefits is that you can work on any one of these problems you want to work on, and you can talk about it in public. In fact, you're encouraged to talk about it in public. And most of the companies that I've been involved with in an advisory capacity, or at one point I took a leave of absence for a little bit and worked full-time at a company. And there the big difference that I noticed was that because the machine learning technology we were developing was so valuable, it would have been just crazy to talk about it in public or to reveal what it was that we were doing. And so to me, the big difference is that in the university environment, you're paid by how much you can convince people to listen to you. And in the company environment, at least in terms of the underlying technology, you really should not be spilling the beans, but instead getting people to buy your product. So it's just a very different thing. And I enjoy the research part and the idea of brainstorming with people and communicating the way that you do around a university. So for me personally, that's why my career is here at the university.
Now, you talked about a lot, and as I mentioned, you're a leading authority in the world in your field. And there's implications to your field, to economics, epidemiology, genomics, robotics, sociology. I mean, I can't think of a field that isn't impacted with the results of your work in some way. So from your perspective then, and, you know, the audience is going to want to know, what are the best online resources to use to find out more, to get involved?
Oh, to learn about machine learning, you mean? There's a wonderful course offered by Coursera. Andrew Ng teaches this course. You can take it for free if you want to do that. There are, come to the Machine Learning Department website and browse around. If you come to my own webpage, you'll see a video course that I've put online, videoed from the course that I teach here at Carnegie Mellon. So there are a number. There's also a wonderful website called videolectures.net, which has literally thousands of more technical videos of computer scientists presenting work, but a large fraction of that is machine learning. So I think there are a lot of things like that that are open to everybody on the web. And there are an increasing number of just YouTube videos of seminars and things like that that are available. So that plus Wikipedia, you can never go wrong with, well, I guess you could, but Wikipedia is also a great resource. So when I think of, for example, when I got involved in neuroscience, how I learned about that, it was some combination of textbooks, lectures, talking with people, courses, and Wikipedia, which provides in layman terms pretty good explanations of a lot of terms.
Let me extend that by saying that Tom has appeared in the ACM Learning Center webinar series, where he did a recent webinar on NOW, and where there's quite an interesting question and answer session. In addition to that, there's the ACM Digital Library, which has the largest repository of scientific research in computing science, and is used by governments, corporate labs, and also research centers and universities worldwide. Now, this leads me to my next question, and that is, Tom, what are your views on policy changes that are needed by the government?
Well, I guess I have two things that I raised in passing before, but I do think that there is a huge opportunity for society to benefit from all this growing volume of data that's available online. And that isn't just in terms of, a single application, but across many aspects of society. You know, we could improve and already are improving real-time traffic reports, but we could go the next step and have our traffic control systems, our traffic lights, for example, intelligently respond to those real-time traffic assessments that we get from the mobile phones that everybody has in their pocket as they're driving to work, and the phone company is relaying as real-time traffic reports. But also, you know, across many, many walks of life, we're in the beginning phases of a decades-long trend toward more data-driven, empirically grounded decisions, which I think is a healthy trend. As I mentioned before, I think that the machine learning algorithms will be there. We already have some. They will get better. And I think the limiting factor in terms of how imaginative we can be as a society in ways of using this data to make better decisions, both as individuals and as a society, the limiting factor, it seems to me, will be our ability to deal with the very important privacy issues that are there, and also with the natural tendency of commercial organizations to get the data and hide it from others, as opposed to the potential societal benefit of everybody having access to that data so that everybody can think of some imaginative use of it. And so I think we're just way behind in this country and probably others in terms of noticing that opportunity and beginning the discussion about how to, what kind of policy we want to put in place in terms of data sharing, data access, data privacy, data hoarding, hoarding in the sense that there's very valuable data perhaps that a drug company may have, and maybe for commercial reasons they don't want to share that with other drug companies, but maybe that could be very valuable to the medical research community in some other sense. And so it's not clear what the right policy should be, but I guess to put it in a phrase, data will become wealth. And we need a way to, we need discussion, we need some new thinking, and we need to begin the discussion about how to deal with this future where, unlike in the past, a large part of wealth creation will surround who collects and who owns and who has access to the data. And how do we deal with the privacy issues in the cases where those are around? So it's a complex set of issues, but I just feel like we're way behind in getting started on having a rational discussion as a society about that. So to me, that's actually the main area where I'd like to, I'm not sure it's a policy change at this point, but it's more of a awareness and a discussion, at the society level. The other thing we touched on before, but again, I would raise it is, you know, people talk about the singularity and computers will be more intelligent than us. And I think that's the wrong way to think about it. But we should instead be thinking about individual competences of computers and whether we want to allow computers to do X or Y or Z. And one example I mentioned before is, do we want computers to be able to control automated weapons? And we're kind of walking into that as a government without very much public discussion as far as I can see. And it seems to me these are important questions that we do need to have a serious discussion and not just kind of wake up 20 years from now and find out that we have weaponized robots in the world and we didn't see it coming.
You know, it's interesting talking about the implications of not regulating the use of this data and how it can empower autonomous machines, perhaps. It's kind of this sort of fear of a Skynet, sort of from Terminator or something like that. But we're talking about a lot of data. I mean, what is it? 2 zettabytes of data are out there, and the majority was generated in the last 2 years. I mean, how do you get a handle on that, right?
Yeah, it's a huge amount of data, and nobody, it's so interesting to realize that if you just think about that volume of data that is online today, also think about the fact that no single person and no single organization can access all that data. It's there. We as a population on Earth can't have access to it, but no one of us has access to it, and no government has access to it, and no organization does. So what does that mean about how we might think about a more distributed use of that data where, as a world, we get the benefit of it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to centralize those 2 zettabytes into one person's computer or one organization's computer, but maybe we just leave it all out there, but instead organize the team of us in some way where the knowledge gleaned from that data gets passed around, or statistical summaries of that data get passed around, or maybe just the machine learning algorithms get passed around from data center to data center, and they absorb what they can from that data and then move on. But, you know, when you realize that all that data out there, no single entity has access to, it makes you realize that we should be thinking computationally in terms of more distributed kinds of ways of taking advantage of it.
Or I guess our reliance on it, you know, you have an EM pulse and it wipes out the grid. We talked about a lot during this interview. Are there any disruptive changes that we're missing in our discussion here?
Well, we've talked about so many, I don't think I'd add any to that. You just mentioned an important point, though, the EMP possibility. I mean, we are becoming more and more reliant, let's just say, on computation and our communication infrastructure. And it is rather amazing to think about what would happen if, let's say the power was out for a week, or, you know, or we had a meltdown of computational resources at some point.
Well, it's interesting. I spoke at the 2 World Economic Forums in Astana, ASTAX, and I talked about that, our reliance on this thing, and we have like a $73 trillion global economy. And I predicted that rapidly to drop to something like under $14 trillion.
You know, that's one of, so, you know, many people think if there is a next war, it will be, that will be the nature of the war, is to, cyber and power, kind of, you know, energy, electricity and computation will be the target.
Now, we're down to our last 3 questions. These are sort of more general in nature, and this one, I'm not sure if you can give a viewpoint on it, but I'm going to throw it out there anyways. You know, we talked about computing. It's everywhere. It's pervasive. It's ubiquitous. Do you feel that computing itself should be a recognized profession on par with accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
I guess I think it is a respected profession in the same sense as accounting. And I guess I don't have a strong opinion on that question, to be honest. But I can see benefits of having that kind of professional code, and especially getting to some of the ethical questions. I think as a rule, without that code, many people, many of us have an opportunity to just ignore the ethical questions. And I think they are with us. And so one advantage of having such a professional code is that it focuses our attention on those ethical questions and gets us to come to some consensus.
Now, Tom, you're a recognized expert, as I mentioned, highly respected worldwide for your really leading research, and will continue to be so. And you're going to win many awards and be recognized in your career for it. So from all of this work, from your extensive speaking travels, do you have any interesting stories to share? Maybe something unexpected, amazing, amusing, or surprising?
Oh, wow. Well, there are many, but I'll just tell you one of the early ones that happened to me. I was very fortunate when I became when I graduated from graduate school and got my first job as an assistant professor at Rutgers University. I had a wonderful chair of the department. His name was Saul Amorell, and he taught me just a whole lot about science and how to pursue it, and how to be strategic in choosing research problems, and very much was my mentor. And unfortunately for me, he was also very popular and busy and famous, and so I didn't get to spend that much time with him, but I would treasure every chance I got. And so finally, after I'd been at Rutgers for about a year, I guess it was, Saul and I got invited to the same conference in France, this was. And so, yeah, I was excited to go to the conference in France, but maybe even more excited by the idea that finally I would have some time, travel time, to spend with Saul myself. and have a more one-on-one time with him. And so we went to the conference, and of course at the conference he was very busy because everybody knew of him and knew him and wanted to talk to him. But after the conference was over, we finally agreed, let's just go out to dinner in this little French town in the on the way back to Paris. And I thought, okay, this is great. I'm going to have a great opportunity to get with Saul. And so we sat down, we started eating dinner, and darned if this guy didn't come up to the table and say, "Excuse me, are you Saul Amorell?" And it turns out it was a former student from Rutgers who happened to be passing through this little town in France and recognized Saul. And it was just kind of, to me, one of the more memorable humorous things. And Saul and I laughed about that many, many times afterwards. When he had forgotten that story, but I could bring it up. But for me, I guess that's more of a story about my fondness for Saul and the importance that his mentorship was to me.
And I guess your researchers, your fellow researchers, your graduate students would be sort of looking up to you, and you have the ability to extend your experiences to them. Now we're down to our last question. If you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
You know, I think I'd ask one more question, which is, what's your advice to new graduate students and researchers in computer science? I want to ask that question because I want to give an answer, which is this. Computer science really has a very important future, and a lot of exciting things are going to happen over the coming decades. And during the career of anybody who's starting out now, the next 40 years is just going to be amazing. Just look back at where we were 40 years ago and just see them, you know, just how far it has come. And we'll probably go even further in the next 40. My advice, though, to somebody who's a beginning researcher is to think about the following facts. And this is a question I often ask my own students, these questions. How many papers do you think were research papers were written this year in computer science? Okay, nobody knows the answer, but most people answer like, oh, I don't know, 3,000, 5,000, something. So, okay, how many of those papers did you read? And people usually look embarrassed, but if they're honest, they say, oh, I don't know, maybe 20 last year. Okay, so you read about 1%. Yeah, okay. How did you decide which of those papers you were going to read? And the answer usually comes back, my friend told me about this exciting paper, and right, so I read it, or it was by this person who previously wrote a great paper, and it came out of a new one, so on. Okay, so then the thing to think about here is there are many more papers that are written than are widely read. And the important thing in terms of thinking about how to do research is to realize that there are many more papers written than are actually widely read. And to also at the same time realize that anybody who is at the level of doing research usually has many more ideas that they could pursue than they have time to pursue. And so my advice is think very strategically about your choice of research problem. Avoid the temptation to say, here's an easy thing for me to do, and there's some funding for me to do it, and therefore I will do it. And instead replace that strategy by one that says, here's what I think are the biggest opportunities in the next decade for breakthroughs, and therefore a sub-goal for achieving that breakthrough is to achieve this first step, and I'm going to work on that. And I think as a field and in terms of mentoring our junior researchers, we need to do a better job of getting people to think out on the horizon of what are the big changes that we could, as a field of computer scientists, produce, and then target our research and communicate why we're doing it in terms of those really important goals, and to avoid the what's actually in many ways an easier strategy of saying, oh, I know I could make this small change to this algorithm and get funding to do it and publish a paper on it. That's not really why we're here. That's not the important thing. It's an opportunity of a lifetime to change the world, and we should choose our how to spend our time wisely in terms of choosing research problems that are really targeted toward the big changes.
Hey, that's a fundamental property or law of careers beyond research.
It is.
That's very good advice to the audience, and I thank you for that question and answer. Very good one. Well, Tom, you know, we've had this great discussion, and I know your schedule is demanding, and you're a world-recognized researcher, and, you know, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do the interview. So thank you so much for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thanks, Steve. I enjoyed the conversation.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Tom Mitchell, global top scientist, who shared his deep insights on machine learning, the brain, and policy, and much, much more.